I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Monday at 1 means it's time for all things political. And our guest this hour, we're delighted to have Ron Elving with us, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. He's frequently heard as a news analyst. He writes for NPR.org, and he's on NPR's Popular Politics podcast. Listen to one of those this morning, and it's very interesting. He's won just about every award given out in radio journalism, along with his team at NPR. He was the political editor for USA Today and for Congressional Quarterly, is the author of Conflict and Compromise, How Congress Makes the Law. He has taught at several colleges, and he was the State Capitol Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal. We have a lot to talk about. The Electoral College, of course, is voting today. Wisconsin's 10 votes went to Donald Trump. There was some talk that some electors may vote for somebody else other than Donald Trump. We will see at the end of the day, but it would appear, of course, that Donald Trump is going to win that vote. We have a lot more to talk about with Russian interference in the U.S. election. The White House, of course, has asked for a full analysis of tampering with elections going back to 2008. We also have had senators send a letter to Mitch McConnell saying that they want a full briefing of what has happened here. There is some concern about what the public is going to be able to know about this. It's classified information, but how do you get information to the American people without letting people know how you got the information? We'll be talking about that. The President of the United States now, Barack Obama, has said that he would like to rehabilitate the Democratic Party, that it ceded too much territory to Republicans in local races. We'll talk about how that may happen. But overall, how to respond to Russia's hacking during the election is going to be a big chunk of what we talk about this hour. As always, we'll welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that is at K Dunn Show. Hello, Ron. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Kathy.
Hi,
it's
Ron.
Good to be with you.
Welcome to Wisconsin. Well, it's all the way
good
up
to hear your voice from there.
And good to hear yours. 16 degrees, but we suffered through minus 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 over the last few days, and we have a lot of snow. So
yes, and the Packers won. So
and the Packers won.
It's all cool.
So everything is okay. Well, let's start with this Russian hacking story. You said something interesting on the podcast I was listening to this morning, that eventually Donald Trump may come around to the idea that the Russians did hacking and wants an investigation. Do you think that's going to happen? And really, wouldn't it, if he, as he believes, there wasn't any hacking going on here, that this is not really true, that if there's a full investigation, if what he believes is true, we'll eventually know that that is true?
It's a difficult position to maintain that there was not hacking. It's clear there was hacking. There was hacking of the Democrats. There were attempts to hack into Republican websites and into the personal email of Republican figures. That was not as successful. At least we don't think so, because the Russians chose not to share any of the information that they got from the Republican side, which is part of the reason why the intelligence community believes that the Russian efforts were largely devoted to defeating the Democrats and electing whomever the Republicans nominated, particularly after they had nominated Donald Trump, someone who has been considerably more open to a relationship with Russia than the Democrats, and specifically much more so than Hillary Clinton. So it's tough to maintain there wasn't hacking. It's not hard to understand why Donald Trump does not want to pin that on the Russians right at this particular moment. As you said earlier, the Electoral College is voting today. Not that there's any real suspense about that, but what suspense there might have been was largely driven by the sense that some electors would be waiting to know more or wanting to know more about this Russian connection before they voted. So with that in the past, it seems time for Donald Trump to say, let's have the investigation, see where it points. He obviously doesn't think he has anything to hide, so there's really no reason for him to oppose an investigation.
You talk about the Electoral College, some of them wanting more information or to be briefed on this. Were they briefed? What happened with that?
They were not briefed. They did not get an intelligence briefing on this. That idea was probably impractical and maybe even fanciful. The idea that you would suddenly let 538 people who had not been vetted by the intelligence agencies have a briefing that had in it information that, as you mentioned a moment ago, might well compromise some of our intelligence sources around the world. That's not something the intelligence communities would be for. And when President Obama was asked about it last week, he indicated that he did not intend to do that.
Mm-hmm. It is kind of an unusual situation here, Ron, and I wonder how the president proceeds. I wonder how people in his administration who are in a number of important national security positions will proceed, particularly the new director of the CIA, when you have some senators calling for a very broad congressional investigation of the cyber attacks. And then you have, I believe it was Kellyanne Conway saying yesterday, there's no evidence of foreign interference. What do you do with that? Two completely conflicting ideas here.
And two really different issues, I think, as well. And that's part of the reason for the confusion. When you talk about foreign interference, that implies that in some way or another, a foreign country actually had something to do with the vote casting or the vote counting or in some way or another interfered with Election Day. We don't have any evidence of that. That's not what the intelligence community is talking about. But it is the implicit accusation that Kellyanne Conway and a lot of other spokespersons from the Republican Party have been answering. They've been talking about how the Election Day wasn't hacked. And really, that's not at issue. No one is saying Election Day itself was hacked by the Russians or anyone else. In fact, we've just had a compilation of reports from the secretaries of state and the elections boards around the 50 states, and that has indicated that it was really a rather calm and normal election day with a very little evidence of anyone attempting any sort of fraudulent activity, and that would include any attempt to hack into the computers that various states use. So that issue is really not the issue. That's a bit of a red herring. That's a bit of a distraction. The real issue here is whether or not the Russian government, directed by Vladimir Putin, who is, after all, a former KGB man himself and very much in charge of the intelligence efforts and actions of his country, whether or not the Russian intelligence establishment made a mission of getting into the computers, particularly of the Democratic Party, particularly of Hillary Clinton and the Democratic National Committee, but also many other Democratic campaigns around the country and Democratic committees, in order to get information that could then be made public through WikiLeaks or some other means, and thereby embarrass and to some degree hobble the Democratic effort in the 2016 election. That's the real live operative accusation here.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense of how far the White House investigation, this analysis, is proceeding and what the president may be doing to counter what the Russians did?
There does not seem to have been much of an effort made by the American counterintelligence community to specifically stop whatever was going on with the Democratic Party. Their emphasis has been over the years to prevent some kind of hacking into our defense establishment or some sort of hacking into power grids or something else of that nature that would have a clear national security implication, as opposed to hacking into, say, a particular college or a particular business. There has been a certain amount of cyber espionage, of course, that's been done by various countries, certainly not exclusively the Russians, with a commercial purpose, with a steal their plans, steal their business secrets kind of a mission. But the main focus for the government's counterintelligence efforts has been to protect the government's secrets, to protect the Defense Department and other parts of the federal establishment. As far as the Democrats are concerned, the attitude seems to have been they're on their own. The White House may or may not have been aware before the FBI and some of the intelligence agencies that this was going on, but that it does not seem to have been aware of that at any point until they were told by the FBI and by the intelligence community. And there has been a certain amount of grumbling and dissatisfaction on the part of many that the White House didn't do more, that the White House didn't send up some sort of enormous national flare, address the country, tell everyone that the Russians are coming, something of that nature. And the president indicated at his last press conference of the year last Friday, that he thought that that would have been disproportionate, that it would have been perceived as a political act, something that was being done to help Hillary Clinton or help Democratic candidates in general. I think it's pretty safe to say it would have been so perceived by many. And the president decided that that was not appropriate.
Mm-hmm. And did he also think she was going to win?
You know, he didn't say that on Friday. But I think it's quite clear and has been reported by a number of people based on sourcing that the White House felt that anything really disruptive, anything that was anything that really seemed to go over the top in blaming either the Russians or just talking about this hacking helping Donald Trump would possibly be counterproductive. And they believed they had a margin. They believed they had a safety net. They believed that states such as Wisconsin were not going to go Republican for the first time since 1984, which was the last time that the state of Wisconsin voted for a Republican. That was Ronald Reagan. So they just didn't see that coming. They were caught by surprise, not only by Wisconsin, but by Michigan, Pennsylvania. And that really was the reason that Hillary Clinton lost.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the American public, Ron, how much of this information, which I assume is very classified, highly classified information from the CIA, the American public would like to know the details here. Will we ever know those, or is it so classified that it won't be released to us?
That's an excellent question. There are many details that perhaps will come out if the Senate does have a select committee on the model of, say, the Senate Watergate Committee back in 1973. If something of that order were to happen, a great deal might come to public knowledge. If, on the other hand, they handle this within the confines of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senate Armed Services Committee, those committees are quite accustomed to having quiet briefings in secure rooms. They actually have some rooms they call the crypt in the Capitol, where they are heavily assured that no one can bug the room, no one can be hearing about it, no one can get any information out. And there they have intelligence officials or defense officials brief members of Congress. And perhaps we'll see something of that nature, and then we'll see something a little more public a little later on. But it will not be nearly as information-rich as it would be if there were a select committee and a much more public kind of hearing, the sort of thing that could be carried on NPR, the sort of thing. By the way, NPR was covering those hearings way back in the 1970s with respect to Watergate and the eventual impeachment proceedings against Richard Nixon, and that was sort of the model for how you would cover something of that nature 24/7, or cover it gavel to gavel, as we say. PBS was also involved in that, and it really was an education for a whole generation of Americans. It truly was.
Yes, it was. Made some people go into journalism, didn't it?
I think you could count me among them, Kathy. Yeah. I think that's an actual fact.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a good thing. What about all of these people, cabinet positions, and some of the national security advisors that may need congressional approval? And tell me how many do and how many don't. You remind us of the fact that there are still 48 Democrats in the Senate, and when it comes to this Russian hacking story, you have several pretty outspoken Republican senators who are saying that they want to get to the bottom of all of this, which A, would indicate that there will be fairly complete congressional hearings on this issue. Does that also mean that there might be some problems for someone like Rex Tillerson, who's got a lot of connections and a long past with Russia and financial interests there as well, for Secretary of State confirmation?
Yes, Rex Tillerson, of course, is CEO of ExxonMobil. And ExxonMobil has, for many years, been in partnership with the Russian government in developing various kinds of oil and gas properties. They have a large pending deal to drill in the Arctic, and that could be a very rich, rich contract worth billions and billions of dollars for ExxonMobil, and, of course, also worth a great deal to Russia. So that was suspended when, over the Crimea crisis and then the Eastern Ukraine crisis, the United States and NATO imposed sanctions on Russia, and as a result, that deal could not go forward. Now, Rex Tillerson is on the record saying he thinks that those sanctions are unnecessary, that they're a bad thing, that they don't actually make any difference to the Russian attitude towards Crimea or Ukraine, whole separate discussion. And he has said that they should go forward. Now, one assumes he will have a somewhat different point of view, and he's not just representing the shareholders of ExxonMobil, but rather all the taxpayers of the United States. But we don't know yet, and that'll surely be one of the questions that he is asked when he comes before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee early next year.
Mm-hmm. The president has said that he wants to, and I don't know how he's going to do this, maybe you have more information on this, rehabilitate the Democratic Party. He said that it has ceded too much territory to Republicans in local races. I think that a lot of Democrats would probably agree with him that it needs to be rehabilitated. What measures might he take, and what measures are Democrats taking at the moment to rehabilitate the party?
You know, a pretty good example of what the president's talking about is the history of Wisconsin in the last several election cycles. Even as it has voted Democratic, as I mentioned a moment ago, consistently since 1988 in presidential elections, it has been back and forth between the parties as far as the governorship and as far as the United States senators races. And we now have a majority of Republicans in the House delegation from Wisconsin. And it is quite typical for a state to elect vote for a Democratic president nowadays and then have quite an array of Republicans in all the other important mm-hmm. offices at the federal level and at the state level. And that has become quite common. You see that in Michigan, and you've seen it in other states as well. So that is what the president is talking about. And the way that you generate a different situation is, one, probably in all likelihood, you elect a Republican president, and he may do things that some people don't like. That gets people's attention, gets them more involved in politics, gets them out there to do something at the local and state level, and that would make a difference. If people want to organize against Donald Trump at some point in his presidency, beyond the Electoral College vote today, then the most effective way for them to do that is the way the Republicans organized against Barack Obama or against Bill Clinton back in the 1990s. You go local. You run for what offices you can, what offices you can win. You build that up to the state legislative offices. Then you go on to the congressional offices, on to the statewide offices. And that's how you get the party back in shape.
Mm-hmm. And yet that didn't happen in Wisconsin after Republicans took control of everything.
It didn't happen when they took control of everything in the state.
Right.
What I'm talking about is reaction against a presidential controversy. Now, one of the things that really helped Scott Walker, starting back in 2010 and then in his two subsequent statewide wins, was a certain amount of resentment in the state against things that were perceived to be happening with the Obama administration, which is, of course, a nationwide question. But sometimes the most effective way to get going in a given state with a Democratic Party that may have been, you know, knocked back on its heels for some period of time is by changing the national discussion to focus on the actions of a Republican president, for example, George W. Bush. He was elected in 2000, reelected in 2004, but because of the unpopularity of the Iraq War and things that were going wrong there and other things that people perceived as being negative stories out of the Bush administration, say the Katrina disaster down in New Orleans in 2005, because of those kinds of events, the Republican Party suffered in the states, and the Democratic Party got stronger. And that was true in Wisconsin, where the Democrats made a comeback in the Jim Doyle era. And it was true in a lot of other states as well. And the Democrats took control of the House and the Senate in the 2006 midterm elections. That seems to be the way the physics, you know, the back and forth, the one action and then an equal and opposite reaction of our politics works.
Ron Elving is our guest for All Things Political today, senior writer, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. Our phone number, one line is open, 800-486-8655. The email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. And you are listening to All Things Political on the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls for Ron. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we start with Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, you know, it's troubling to me in regards to what's happened in the state of Wisconsin since the Republicans have taken power and redistricting, which has been called the worst gerrymandering in the history of the country, that even though there are a fairly equal number of Republican and Democratic voters, the representation is almost all Republican. And our governor, you know, when he takes oath, he says he's going to represent the people of Wisconsin, but I feel like he really represents the Republican Party. But that's not why I called. I called about the issue with Putin and the president-elect's relationship with Putin and other people in his cabinet, their relationships to Putin, and former his campaign manager Paul Manafort's connections to Putin. And Putin has been, since he was a young man, he has been in the KGB. He studied at their school. He made himself useful to the mayor of St. Petersburg and to Yeltsin, and he's been involved in basically stealing the reform and democracy movement in Russia. He's been accused by British courts of being involved in the murder of a Russian journalist in London, by Dutch courts of being involved in the shooting down of a domestic airline, KLM flight, over the Ukraine. He's taken illegal actions all over the world. So he is, you know, what John McCain, I agree with him, he's a thug, he's a criminal, he's a murderer. And I think for Donald Trump, you know, when this information about the hacking of the U.S. election by the Russians, he's not only was he not concerned, he was trying to politicize the, like it was an attack on him, when it was really an attack on our democracy, all the people, not just Donald Trump, but this is his nature, to personalize everything. Like this, while this is going on, he's tweeting about a review of his restaurant.
Ron, a response.
Willem has a great deal of factual material there with respect to Vladimir Putin. Those are the facts. That is the court record. These are the things that have been said about him. They are the things that have also been shown to be true about him in many instances. And they affect not just the United States, but many other countries around the world and the journalists of many other countries around the world. There has also been a great deal of pressure put on journalists within Russia by the Putin regime. Now, none of that necessarily has to attach itself to Donald Trump, unless Donald Trump sees fit to attach himself to Vladimir Putin. There is some degree of mutual respect, apparently, between these two leaders. Donald Trump has said what a strong leader he thinks Vladimir Putin is. He has said on a number of occasions that it would be a good thing if we could work more closely with the Russians, in particular in Syria, to try to put an end to that war, although Putin's idea of how to put an end to that war is by supporting the dictator Assad in that country, and that is a chilling and horrific way to imagine that civil war coming to an end, although it does seem to be going in that direction in Aleppo as we speak. So, yes, there is much disturbing about the potential relationship between these two men when Donald Trump becomes the leader of the United States.
Mm-hmm. When do you imagine he might have a press conference so he can be asked about these questions and many others?
Not soon, would be my guess. He has not had one for 145 days, and if that seems excessively bookkeeping-ish, journalists are like that. We did that all through 2016 when Hillary Clinton was not having news conferences. We said how many days it had been, and months went by before she started having news conferences again late in the summer. Now we've been counting for almost 5 months with Donald Trump. He promised us a news conference on December 15th where he was going to explain how he would deal with his businesses while he was president of the United States and to avoid conflicts of interest. That news conference did not take place. We are now told there will be a statement in January on that subject, but not promised a news conference. And he has met with some journalists. He's been meeting with some journalists in just the last couple, 3 days on an off-the-record basis, and he then has photographs taken of himself with those journalists after having given them basically an off-the-record briefing. And I suspect that those photographs are going to be put forward as evidence that he is meeting with journalists and in some sense having news conferences, but he has not.
I saw some of those pictures from Mar-a-Lago. Was NPR invited to that?
We have not, to my knowledge, been invited, and we have not participated. I'm not saying that we would never participate. After all, this is the President of the United States. And so if invited to have an opportunity to speak to him and question him, we will, as I understand it at least, have the attitude that we have no choice, that he is the President, and we want to speak to him and have him speak to our hosts and our reporters. We were not able to get him on our air during the campaign year, although once it was scheduled and then canceled. And we would anticipate that either in a public or in a off-the-record session, we would go and we would speak to him. I think we have already made a policy statement with respect to any photographs or other representation that might in some sense misrepresent how we were involved in such an event. But more to come on that particular subject, Kathleen.
The Russian ambassador to Turkey was assassinated inside an art gallery today. Have we heard any Russian response to that? When something like this happens, you get worried because it's such a troubled part of the world. We don't know exactly who did it. They're saying terrorists did this. But I'm wondering about a response from Russia, what they're likely to do.
We have only heard, we have seen an official response from the United States government, from the White House, expressing their condolences, expressing concern for the family of the ambassador. There were a number of others wounded as well in that incident. As I understand it, the ambassador has just died very recently, just in the last hour or two. And that may have been misreported, but that initially it was reported as a wounding of the ambassador. So this is all very much a story in progress, and I have not seen an official response yet from the Russians. Doubtless there will be more than a statement.
Yes, I'm sure. Willem, thanks for the call. Charlie in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. One thinks about Watergate and as well as the Pentagon Papers, how important journalism is in telling the voters and the public the truth, and how important it is that we listen to good reporting. So the question about the Russian hacks and the WikiLeaks lead me to question, were any of these emails that were released touched up or altered? I mean, the WikiLeaks showed that Hillary Clinton knew that Benghazi was a terrorist attack, and it also showed the pay-to-play of the Clinton Foundation. Were any of these things not true? Because that would really have affected how I voted. The second thought that I have with that is that, are we hacking the Russians? And if so, or if not, why aren't we, as for our own defense? Thanks so much.
Thanks, Charlie.
I think it's safe to say, and I think that President Obama made this clear on Friday, that there is a great deal of surveillance, espionage, whatever you want to call it, hacking that goes on back and forth between world powers, us and the Chinese, people in NATO. We have known that in past years, some of the telephone calls of NATO leaders were intercepted by United States intelligence agencies, and there has been a certain amount of embarrassment associated with that. There is a difference between listening in and then releasing everything or some selected parts of what you obtain through that surveillance with the intent of torpedoing, if you will, or sabotaging certain politicians in the midst of a political campaign. And that's really the main distinction between the kinds of, I wouldn't call it routine necessarily, but let's just say it's well-established hacking that goes on in between world powers and the kind of thing that Russia has just perpetrated in 2016.
Thanks, Charlie, for your call. Let's go to Nick in Brilliant. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Every time I hear about this CIA crisis of hacking and whatnot, it's like, and how they're going to have this big, huge undertaking, this committee of, you know, fact finders, and for us American public, I keep on thinking, geez, I wish they would have done that about our jobs leaving in Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, all the states the Democrats needed. You know, only if they would have done their job, maybe they would still have a job, you know?
Why did the Democrats lose, Ron?
The Democrats lost because, as your caller is indicating, they persuaded people, or people became persuaded, that the Democrats did not care enough about the changes that were happening in the economy as they affected workers. That they, some of the Democrats were very anti-trade, or I shouldn't say anti-trade, but anti the kind of deals that cost jobs. Many of the Democrats fought very hard against deals that they saw as being difficult for American workers. I would point to, for example, Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, but many others as well, and certainly Bernie Sanders had a record of opposing those kinds of trade deals. There have not been a great number of opportunities in the last several years for Democrats to have hearings on any subject in Washington because they haven't had control of the House or the Senate. But when they did have control of the Senate, was this enough of a focus when there was a trade deal? Did they do enough to make sure that American workers would not be adversely affected by, say, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, the most recent trade deal that President Obama supported, that Hillary Clinton supported until she turned against it during the 2016 election year? That is certainly an indictment that can be made against the Democratic Party, that in their support for a global trade, for global prosperity, for doing more on the world stage to improve the economic standing of people across the entire world, they did not think enough about how that was affecting people in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, and all of those states are exactly the place where the Obama coalition collapsed, particularly with respect to white working class people.
What's your best guess, Ron, when you look at the number of appointments that have already been made? Some of them need to be confirmed, but in many cases, the appointments are of people who have very different ideas about the philosophy of the agency and the mission of the agency that they will soon be heading. Do you think we're going to see a radical transformation of what's happening with the environment, what's happening with clean air, what's happening with energy issues, what's happening with public schools in this country? Do you anticipate some very, very different ways of America being America?
These things don't happen overnight, Kathleen. You know, we're not going to see the EPA fold up its tent on January 21st. We're not going to see the Department of Education abolished. And we're not going to see the Department of Energy abolished, even though its new secretary is someone who said that was one of the three agencies in the government he would obliterate. It's going to take a period of time, and the thing that we're going to see in the early weeks and months is a change of direction with respect to enforcement. You're not going to be able to wipe out all the laws that are on the books that tell these agencies what they're supposed to do. What you could do, though, is you could pull the plug on a lot of the enforcement efforts that are being made, whether it's by the Justice Department with respect to voting rights, or the Environmental Protection Agency with respect to clean air, or whether it's the Department of Education and its mission with respect to public education versus private education. We know that Betsy DeVos at Education, she's going to be the new Secretary of Education. I don't think there's any question she'll be confirmed. And she is going to take the view that we need to move away from public education as much as we can towards charter schools, towards private schools, towards vouchers. This has been her position for a number of years. And we've seen that really in department after department. I think Scott Pruitt, as the new head of EPA, he's the Attorney General of Oklahoma, has 12 pending lawsuits that he himself has filed against the EPA. So we can imagine what his disposition towards those will be when he represents the EPA.
Mm-hmm. And what happens to all the lawsuits that are against Donald Trump right now? There's one concerning the hotel. There are other outstanding lawsuits. Do those all go by the wayside when he becomes president? And the people that he has said that he is going to sue, or maybe there's something already in the works here. What happens with all of that?
Years ago, there was an assumption that the President of the United States could not be pulled into a civil lawsuit while serving as President of the United States, and that no one could subpoena the President while he was in office. Then we had a President named William Jefferson Clinton. And in the 1990s, and particularly in his second term, the laws or the presumptions or the interpretations and court rulings that had established those precedents were pretty much all overturned. That's how we got Bill Clinton testifying in the summer of 1998 in such a manner that he got himself impeached. We now have a set of precedents and rules that would suggest that a president can continue to be a focus of civil and even criminal proceedings while he's in office. So we shall see how some of those legal matters that you're talking about proceed. My guess is most of them, things such as Trump University, have already been settled out of court. I think we're going to see a lot of settlements out of court.
We're talking with Ron Elving this hour for All Things Political, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. And let's go to Judith in Milwaukee next. Hi, Judith.
Hi. I'm wondering, given the debacle of the election, I'm guessing that the inner circle of the Democratic Party is doing a lot of, hand-wringing, but parsing of where they went wrong with their strategy. And I'm particularly wondering, I know this is probably not public knowledge, but what are the rumors of where blame is being placed for abandoning Russ Feingold and the entire state of Wisconsin?
That's an excellent question, and there is surely a great deal of blame to be placed. Why the state of Wisconsin fell off the radar for the Clinton campaign? Probably the best answer to that was people got complacent. They looked at all the number of times that the state had voted Democratic for president. Now, again, it's not as though people in Washington don't know about Scott Walker, don't know about Ron Johnson, don't know about the congressional delegation balance. But what people thought was that the electorates that put all those people in office were smaller and whiter and more inclined to vote Republican than the people who have been turning out in Wisconsin's presidential elections back to the late 1980s. So that was the complacency. Also, the polling out of Wisconsin, including the very highly respected Marquette University Law School poll, had indicated right down to the week before the election. And maybe that poll got just a little stale there at the end. Maybe they didn't poll one time and again enough. But this is something that I recall seeing in my years with the Milwaukee Journal, that sometimes we didn't poll long enough into the season. I remember in 1980, we did not poll after a certain point in October, and we missed the fact that Gaylord Nelson, longtime Democratic senator, was about to be upset in November of that year. So that may have happened to the Marquette University Law School poll. This year, they were still showing Hillary Clinton had single digits, of course, and kind of in the middle of the single-digit range. It wasn't a big lead, but it didn't look that bad. And what people really didn't anticipate was the degree to which counties that had voted outstate, not Dane, of course, not Milwaukee County, not even Brown County, but getting out into the northwestern part of the state, central part of the state, counties that voted twice for Barack Obama, in some cases by pretty substantial margins, would turn around and vote by big margins for Donald Trump. That's what people didn't see coming. And there's a lot of blame to go around for that, because too much reliance on past history, too much reliance on polls, and probably too much reliance on journalists has just left us all a little bit vulnerable to getting a big surprise on Election Day.
It was. Thanks, Judith, for the call. Claire in Madison. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Kathleen. How nice to have Mr. Elving on.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yes. I didn't know he was a Wisconsin boy.
I'm a journal alumnus. Let's put it that way.
That's great. I'm calling to comment about this weird thank you tour series Trump just had. I like to call it his ego trips. My question is, and I know this would be very difficult to find out the answer to, what just in security alone this cost taxpayers, all these trips all around the country? Because I went to several primary rallies, and the security, I mean, the places were crawling with cops. You had the TSA to check for weapons with their equipment hauled in from wherever. You had Secret Service. Then you had county, state, and local police, in some cases university police. And then who paid for the venues themselves? Did all of this come out of our pockets or did the Trump campaign pay for these venues? I mean, there had to be huge expenses involved.
By and large, the costs of security at political events are borne not only by the Secret Service, but by the law enforcement officers and jurisdictions of that particular area. So that if you're a small town in Iowa early on in the process, you probably don't see a lot of Secret Service with the candidates. Some of these candidates come and go practically in a car with one driver, and you don't see a lot of security. But by the time you get to the end of the campaign, where there are huge entourages and the Secret Service has really taken over a lot of the logistics, They do a great deal, and that, of course, is federal tax money. We just decided a number of years ago, decades ago, after the assassinations of 1968 and the attempted assassinations against several of our presidents, including Ronald Reagan, who was seriously wounded in 1980, we just decided, essentially as a country, that any price was enough, was not too high to pay for keeping presidents and even presidential candidates from being assassinated. So we spend an enormous amount of money on the Secret Service, and then a certain amount of the cost also is borne by the counties and the cities whose police officers have to put in for overtime. And that's a factor, of course, in putting together these tours. But you know, the alternative is really to say that we don't want to provide security for large crowds. And, of course, we provide security for large crowds for Packer games and Brewer games and Bucks games. And that just is part of the function of being the police. And as far as it being a political event and one party or the other, well, I've been, you know, fielding complaints for the last 8 years from people about how much money it costs for Barack Obama to go to Hawaii for Christmas every year, and fielding complaints for the 8 years prior to that for how much money it costs for George W. Bush to go to Texas.
Right. But you also have New York in the mix here, and to have his tower and his home where he wants to spend, I don't know if this idea has changed, some 3 days a week. If you've got a business right there close to where the Trump Tower is, you've got to be pretty upset right now, don't you? Because don't they have to close down a good portion of Manhattan?
It's crazy, and we have lived with that kind of a motorcade and closing down of streets in Washington for a very long time. But, of course, we deserve it because, after all, we're Washington. And, you know, if you're going to be the government town, you have to put up with that kind of government disruption. New York City, especially Manhattan, especially Fifth Avenue, is going to take a much dimmer view of this.
Sure.
They consider themselves the capital of the world, but they don't particularly
yes.
want to pay the price in that particular regard. So it is going to be a controversy going forward.
Ron Elving is our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political. We have a couple lines open right now. We've been talking about the various calls for investigations into the Russian hacking, the Trump response to this. And, well, I'm wondering more from listeners. What do you think about all of this? Do you want to see a thorough investigation? Should it be made public? The president has said he would like to rehabilitate the Democratic Party, that it ceded too much territory to Republicans. We can talk about that. Any of the cabinet selections or national security positions that the president-elect has announced, that's all up for discussion as well, because Ron knows about all of this. Ron Elving is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. More phone calls. Let's go to John in Toronto. Hello, John.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
All right, John. You?
Hey, love your show, Kathleen.
Thanks, John.
Last time I called was probably a month or so before the election, and my sticking point was the dumbing down of America. Well, never mind. Okay. Now I forgot exactly what I was going to say. I've been on hold for just a slight bit, but anyway. After the Electoral College, that was my other question. Can we just abolish this ancient way of doing the elections, is just going right to the popular vote? How about that?
All right, John. Thanks for the call. Ron.
Well, that's a popular idea.
Mm-hmm.
There have
yes,
been a number of polls done in just the last few days, weeks, that have shown in virtually every poll a clear majority would rather just have a popular vote. Even sometimes polls that are taken by conservative news media have found that people would rather have just a straight popular vote, although right at the moment many Republicans are given pause when they stop and reflect that the last two Republicans to win the presidential election, Trump and George W. Bush, both won, initially at least, by winning in the Electoral College and not the popular vote. The Democrats have won 6 of the last 7 presidential popular votes. And so the Republicans have to be a little wary about just tossing this ancient institution aside. And it is kind of ancient. It goes back to 1787. And the idea of it was to kind of, you know, chill the mob a little bit and tell people, you know, okay, this is the person you want, but you should send actually some representatives to your state capital to talk about this and then let those fellas decide. And of course, they were all fellas in those days. You couldn't even vote unless you were a man. So those electors would go off to their state capitals of the old original colonies and decide that George Washington should be president or John Adams and so on. And the idea was they were just taking an advisory from the actual voters. Well, that's a long time ago, and we've become a much more small-d democratic country, much more egalitarian country. We expect every voter to have some say about who the president is going to be. So this is a bit of an anachronism to still have this around. But look, the Constitution can only be amended by 2/3 votes in the House and Senate, and that then has to be ratified by 3/4 of the states. So if just 13 states say that they like the Electoral College, then we'll have the Electoral College forever. And my guess is you could make a list of 13 pretty fast, pretty fast, of states that would not vote to get rid of the Electoral College, either because they're states that think that it advantages them, and it does advantage some states, and states that also just don't like the idea of doing something that's basically being pushed more by Democrats than by Republicans.
Thanks, John. Mark in La Crosse, hi.
Hi. My question is, does your guests think that Edward Snowden could have remotely played a part in Russia's hacks? And secondly, does Russia really even need Edward Snowden for help in something like that?
My guess would be that they generally the second of your two thoughts there. I think they don't really need Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden, you know, obviously is a highly skilled computer person, but he had access to an awful lot of material by virtue of the job that he had with National Security Agency. That's the nature of his great insight into what was going on at NSA. They probably have people who have more up-to-date skills than anyone who has been sort of sidelined as long as Edward Snowden. So my guess is the Russians have everything they need in the area of expertise and in hacking skills. And also, you know, a lot of this has to be put to elements of our own country. Some of the Democrats were not very careful about their keeping safe their computer information. And even when they got warned about it initially by the FBI, even though it was kind of a strange warning, they did not seem to leap to defend their ramparts the way one would expect them to have done.
It was indeed, though, a strange warning, wasn't it?
It was a very strange warning, coming almost like an anonymous tip,
right,
as opposed to a call from the director or a senior manager at the FBI, which you would have expected.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark. Mariah in Madison. Hi.
Hi. So my question is regarding tweets. I was recently in China, actually, when Donald Trump took the call with Taiwan and then did some tweets afterwards. I'm wondering how you think him tweeting might change, whether he's going to have to cancel his Twitter account or if somebody else is going to take it over, or how that might work.
That's a wonderful question to which I would really hesitate to offer any kind of answer at all. Donald Trump is a highly unpredictable personality in some respects. He prides himself on that, has said many times that unpredictability is a good thing. And with respect to his own personal communications on Twitter, I know he has driven many of his handlers nuts over the course of the campaign year. And there was a period of time, about the last 10 days or 2 weeks of the campaign, where someone seemed to have finally gotten his Android away from him, so that he couldn't do this at 6 o'clock in the morning. And On the other hand, many of his 6 a.m. tweets have driven the news cycle, mm-hmm. as we say, and driven some negative stories that he might not have wanted to see in the cycle, right out of the cycle, because his tweets do tend to get a lot of retweets and a lot of attention, and he may consider that to be a weapon that he could continue to use in the White House.
Mm. What are his largest vulnerabilities as he becomes very close to becoming president? Are there any?
This issue of conflicts of interest, we don't know how it will play. Thus far, I don't think it's captivating the public nearly as much as the theme of Make America Great seems to have done. But at some juncture, there could be a specific conflict of interest that really did bother people. I think potentially that could have to do with Russia. We don't know the full extent of Donald Trump's own business dealings with Russia. Some people believe that's the real reason he hasn't ever released his tax returns. And frankly, I'd be very surprised if he plans to ever release his tax returns. There's no legal requirement that he do so. It's really a political requirement, and he's already survived it. He's already survived and won the election without releasing his tax returns. So we may never know what exactly his business dealings with the Russians are. But at some point or another, that issue could arise, or other conflicts of interest could arise, where Donald Trump Incorporated, the business, is in some sense or another in conflict with the United States of America, the country. And that, I think, could begin to really make a difference and be a vulnerability for him. There's also always the question of what kind of bad things are going to happen and how he's going to deal with them and how he's going to make his case for whatever he does to the American people.
Mm. Ron, thank you so much for being with us. Ron Elving.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
Yeah, great to have you here. Senior editor, correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. He also was the political editor for USA Today and for Congressional Quarterly. And he was the state capitol bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers and KP Whaley for production and on-air producing of this episode of All Things Political. News is coming up from NPR, and we will return and talk about lead in water.